So is Jason keeping away from you just because you're in a mood?
I'm not in a mood.
You are now.
I are now. For fuck's sake. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. With me is my co-host, Ian Mond. How are you, Ian?
I'm all right, thanks.
You a bit sad?
Why?
Oh, why not?
What?
Well, wait, well, I'm a bit sad.
Because this is our penultimate episode.
This is our penultimate episode.
Yeah, we're dropping it on people.
Yeah. It's all getting a little too much logistically. So this is our second last episode, guys.
Forever.
Probably forever.
No, forever.
We might do a...
No.
Okay.
We won't linger. I think lingering is bad.
We wouldn't be lingering so much as occasionally coming back to do, say, an Aurealis special or something. We'll
yeah,
see.
Well, maybe.
We'll call it the second last episode and...
I just don't want to make any, you know, commitments.
It's not a commitment.
It sounds like a commitment.
Okay.
It sounds like...
Sounds like Kirsten not wanting to let go quite.
Yes. But that's all right. That's fine.
Yes. No. So, yes, this will be our last one. We'll record one more episode next month in November, which would have been our last for the year anyway. But, yeah, we've basically decided we can't come back next year for various reasons. So...
Well, how long have we been doing this?
I think this is year six. This is our 67th episode.
Yeah, so I think we've given to the people. We've given back.
You know, there's a little bit in me because next month will be 68. There's just a little bit which says, oh, I'd like to get to 70. That's a nice round number.
Yeah, well.
That's two more special episodes at some stage. We'll see.
I thought we just said 10 minutes before you press record.
See, there we go.
You just changed your mind live to podcast. That's
live to podcast. I can edit that out.
No, that's fine.
No, it's fine.
No, look, it's just a bit difficult at the moment. It's just better that we were thinking of going another year and we had a plan, but we felt, fuck it, let's just pull the pin.
And I think also the fact that next year is the last year of my PhD and also my lovely Jason's last year of his PhD. So I think this house is going to be
I don't want to come into this house for...
You might get tetanus.
Correct.
I'm not sure we're going to clean from like February through to October when we submit.
Yeah, that... No.
Yeah.
And yeah, look, we could have gone the Skype route now that Skype or all that sort of technology has improved a bit.
Yeah, but it's just all the work.
Yeah.
I don't... Honestly, I don't have time to do.
Yeah, because I do nothing. I need to make this extremely clear. Other than the drive to Kirsten's house and the drive back to get Wicked Wings at the KFC in Balan, I do nothing.
That was an unpaid promotion for Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyways, this is the last time we can discuss our birthdays.
It is our birthdays this month. Oh, God, it's my birthday at the end of the month.
And I just had mine.
Yes, happy birthday.
I turn the age you're going to turn. No. You're the age currently that I just turned.
Because you're a year almost older than me.
No, younger.
Younger.
I think we established this many years ago.
I know.
I'm a baby and you're the adult.
I am the crone.
Yes.
Correct.
All right. Well, anyway, so penultimate episode. It's all very sad. Some of you will cry and rend your clothes and mourn. Others will, you know, think, shit, that's an hour and a half of just freed up every month.
Hour and a half. That's conservative.
But just think, in that hour and a half that you now are no longer listening to us, you can listen to many other great podcasts that are out there.
Yes.
I recommend most of Gimlet's podcasts. Not that they're necessarily book ones, but what? I've now done paid advertising for KFC
and
Gimlet.
God.
I know.
Do you have something on the side that I don't know about?
No.
Anyway, we'll say a proper goodbye next month because it is only our penultimate episode. But for now, let's get straight into the two books for this episode.
Yes.
And not keep the lovely listeners waiting any longer with our ramblings about age and logistics.
We didn't do weather. That's a trifecta.
We didn't do weather. Stop it.
Okay. So book one is Confessions.
Yes, by Kanae Minato, which I had not read, but I'd heard about when it was published in English 2 or 3 years ago. And apparently it's been like a massive book in Japan, like Gone Girl type.
I do wonder why it took so long for this book, when you read the history about it, why it took so long for this book to see the light of day in the English-speaking world.
I think it's just a translation issue.
Yeah, but the book was published in 2008 in Japan.
Yes, but I was saying, I think it's just a translation issue, whatever.
But it's such a popular book.
In Japan.
Okay. But it was turned into a movie in 2010, which was shortlisted for the Academy Awards. It got all it's quite a big deal.
Yeah, and maybe that's it won an Oscar actually for best foreign film.
Oh, actually, yeah. No, you're right, it did. Yeah. So it doesn't come out till 2014. I don't know. I think it's a big lag for a
possibly, but we don't know what negotiations went on behind the scenes and so on.
Yeah. Okay, that got technical real quick.
Well, I mean, it's not as easy as buying an English language book from, you know, in America, buying the rights from a UK author or an Australian author.
I know how I stumble into these discussions.
You do without doing any research.
No knowledge, no research, and just sort of say things like blithely, but it came out in 2008, should have been translated immediately.
Slack publishers.
So in 2014 it did come out and it was nominated in 2015 for the Shirley Jackson, didn't win. But that's when I read it, in 2015.
I think that's probably where it came to my attention. And as I said, it's one of those ones on an ever-increasing list of books I was been meaning to read. So I read it.
I read it 2 years ago, so I felt I didn't need to read it again.
You didn't reread it.
Of course I did. Because I'm not a fucking idiot. No, look, even I'm willing to admit, so I haven't reread our second book.
But you didn't read that long ago.
Correct. But this one, I'd forgotten good chunks of it. So, yeah, it would have been a pretty bad podcast if I'd not.
Would have been a whole bunch of me saying stuff and you going, oh, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember now. I did read that book once.
Yeah. So, and I had all I had was my Goodreads mark out of 5 stars. I had no other notes. So.
What did you give it out of 5 stars?
4.
Oh, 4.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. I did. I just reread it. Like, I finished it yesterday. It only took me a day and a half. It's a very short book.
So I'm assuming there's only the one translation.
From what I could tell, by Stephen Snyder.
Yeah, and it's a very good translation. I mean, obviously, I have no idea how faithful it is to the original one.
You're stumbling into it now.
No, I'm just saying, I don't read Japanese. I've known it. But in terms of the words on the page that I read, it's very good.
He could have been making stuff up.
He could have been completely made. I doubt that's the case. The real reason, listeners, we're ending the podcast is Kirsten is getting sick of replying to legal threats because of stuff Mondi says. Yet,
you don't edit these things out, so who's really at fault here? It's not me.
Yeah, so the prose is very straightforward, very direct. And the way that it's structured is in 6 separate confessions, as it were. From the point of view of 5 different people, there are 6 confessions all up, but it's bookended by the same person.
Yes.
And they're all first person. And they don't seem that different a voice to me. In terms of the way sentences are structured, the vocabulary, that sort of stuff.
You don't think there's a tonal difference?
I think there's a tonal difference, but that's kind of in the intent and the motivation behind what the person's saying in that particular chapter. It's not so much a syntactical or vocab or style difference, I think. But each because of the conceit of the book, each chapter, each confession is introduced very clearly as being from a new person, and here's who that person is and here's their context. So it's not confusing.
Okay.
It's not as though they're interleaved chapters like with the girl on the train, where sometimes you'd read a page and a half and then realise who it was that was supposed to be talking. So they're 5 or 6 rather discrete confessions from the same person following one after the other. They don't interleave.
So would you like to provide the plot?
So the plot's really simple. It's a teacher
Yuko Moriguchi.
Yuko Moriguchi, whose daughter, 4-year-old daughter, is murdered accidentally / deliberately. It's a little complicated, by 2 boys in her class, and she takes revenge of a sort. And
of a sort? Oh, I'm pretty sure she takes quite a bit of revenge.
Yes, but it's not the revenge you think it is to begin with.
Yeah, all right, fine, yeah. But it's still revenge. Okay.
Yes, and complications ensue. That plot is stretched out and kind of warped and twists back on itself a little in the whole book, which was, you get a different perspective on events, but also new information is kind of revealed as you go.
Yeah, so that's part of my problem with it.
Okay.
I think that opening from Moriguchi, the T.J. Yuko, is amazing. It's a short story or a novelette on its own. You could take that out of the book and yeah. There you go, that's it, done.
And this is because at the time this opening, the teacher, and the opening is given, in the form of an address to her class.
Yeah, her homeroom.
Her homeroom, and she we don't get any dialogue from other members of the class. It is a monologue, but there are references to questions having been asked and things like that. So it's all her voice, isn't all entirely her words, but she's very much talking to her class, who for the most part are sitting there very quietly.
Well, she gives them a chance to leave when the bell rings.
Probably thinking, what the fuck?
Yeah, well, as I said, she gives them a chance to leave, but they're mesmerised by her words because she basically says, A, my daughter was murdered, B, the two murderers are in this room right now.
Yeah, so who's going to leave?
C, I'm not going to mention their names, but frankly, I may as well have because the way I'm going to describe
knows.
Them.
Everyone knows. Everyone knows who they are.
Yeah.
So at the time it opens, the daughter's death by authorities was ruled as an accidental drowning. She was found floating in the school pool alone, and it was just deemed that she went there and fell into the pool and drowned because she's only 4 years old. But then subsequent to that, the Yuko, the teacher, her mother, found out certain information which led her to put together what she suspected happened, and she confronted the two boys and they basically confessed to her. So this is all the information she is then giving to the class. Which is why, I got to the end of that. It's like, well, where's it going to go? We know everything. and he's, you know, but then it follows through. We have the student, both students actually who committed the crime. We have another girl in the homeroom. And we have the mother of one of the students who committed the crime.
Yes.
And then, as I said, the collection ends with Yuko coming back and doing one more thing.
Yes. We're not going to spoil that.
Okay.
So here's the thing. I think that opening's great. Mm. I think the second part with the female student who... Yep.
She's like the homeroom president.
President. And talking about the bullying that occurs... Mm-hmm. Etc. That is also fantastic. And then it tapers off because we get the same thing told to us basically three different ways. And there are slight differences, but they are major slight differences, but the bulk of it is near identical. It's not like the stories are fundamentally different.
Yeah. And I think there was possibly a tactical error made by Minato I honestly cannot remember, and I only read this book last week, but I think maybe because the voices are so similar, I can't remember exactly where information was dropped. But before we get to Naoki, who's one of the boys who killed the girl, what we're told in Yuko's story, the teacher and the mother, is that he accidentally killed the girl. So
yes.
The whole thing was his friend Shuyu, who's portrayed as a really nasty piece of work, and well, that's not undermined ever, actually, in the book.
No, there's some...
No, him. He's a little sociopath.
He is a sociopath, but there's rationalisation.
There's no rationalisation. He's a sociopath. Anyway, we'll get to that.
All right.
He set out to electrocute the girl and via a mechanism that he made himself and tricked her into kind of activating. So she got electrocuted and she passed out, Naoki, who was his accomplice and his more passive sidekick, I guess, of the homicidal duo, thought the girl was dead and that Shuyu had set him up to take the fall or something. And so he decided he would throw her in the pool so it would look like she just drowned. And then Yuko finds out later that she did actually drown, which meant that the electric shock didn't actually kill her, but Naoki throwing her in the pool did. And that's the initial story that we've given, that yes. one boy meant to kill her
yes.
but failed, and the other boy who didn't mean to kill her actually did.
Yes.
And then we find out that actually as Naoki was throwing her in the pool, she opened her eyes and he realised she was alive and he threw her in anyway.
Yes.
And that bit of information I think is dropped too early.
Yes, it's dropped in the mother's diary entries. She mentions it.
Yeah, and we should have gotten that from Naoki himself yes,
it
later.
It means that Naoki's story just yeah. repeats what the mother just told us.
It does. There's no extra. Well see, what mother is told is that he got a shock, right? He knew, he picked her up, she opened her eyes, he got a shock and kind of dropped her. Whereas Naoki's story tells us that actually he decided.
Yeah, well, he gives us the motivation as to why he didn't just put it back on
the side. But that it wasn't a mistake. Like, yes. he didn't just get shocked and drop her. He decided at that point, oh, she's not dead. Oh, but I'm going to kill her anyway. So it did change it a little, but I think it would have been more effective if we hadn't known that at all.
Yes.
So yeah, that was, yeah, I think that information was just dropped a little bit too early.
See, the problem I have with this book.
Yeah.
Is that the first two sections set us up for something that's going to be quite subtle and not subtle, but something that's going to be philosophical in its outlook, psychological in its outlook.
Yeah.
And there's the last sentence of the second section, which is an essay written by this class president. Her name is Mizuho. She's written this because she wants to get the attention of her teacher. So from a chronological point of view, teacher has just dropped this, done the drop the mic thing where she's told everyone this story and said, oh, that's it, that's my last day, I'm resigning, and vanishes off into the distance.
Oh, and the other thing she did was the class has been on a program all year where they've been given free milk.
Oh, yes, that's actually the fun. Oh, my God, that's actually the key. That's the one.
She doesn't just tell them the story. She yes. also, so.
Okay, so let me do it.
Okay, you do it.
Her husband or partner.
Yep.
Is a saint, is, you know, he's a man.
The father of her child, they're not
partners.
Yeah, they're
not married, yes, that's
but
right.
But they're not even partners because they separate when correct. She finds out he has AIDS.
Thank you. Maybe you should have done this, not me. Anyway, he's considered a saint in Japan because he's gone through hard times, but he has, he'd become a teacher, he has words of wisdom, he's also suffering from AIDS. AIDS plays a major role in this book.
He's a really good guy.
She, the teacher, Yuko, takes his blood and carefully injects it into the milk cartons of the two boys who murdered her daughter.
And tells them at the end of her
leaves
confession.
That as the, and that's the drop the mic
this
moment.
This is what she's done.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's her revenge because she doesn't think even if she went to the police, she doesn't think the boys would be punished because they're both still children and they're under the age when they would be treated with any great seriousness as adults. So she's doing this instead. And it's also, it's not absolute. So she sort of says in some way she's leaving it to fate. Like it's not as though they drink the milk, bang, you've definitely got AIDS. It's like, well, there's a chance. So you spend 3 months waiting, boys, while your blood get tested.
Correct.
Yeah.
So that's the key thing we missed. So the class president, Mizuki, she talks about what happens next in the second piece. And that's about how Shuya comes back to school straight away and gets awfully bullied, as you'd expect. She gets pulled into that.
And Yuko's no longer their homeroom teacher.
Correct.
She left the profession. She's gone away.
Well, she's gone away to spend her time with her partner.
Yes.
Well, one's partner because he's a saint.
Yeah.
While he's dying. And he happens to be dying from AIDS.
So they have a new homeroom teacher who no one likes so much.
He's idealistic and thinks he's Robin Williams in in what's his face?
I didn't make that connection, but yes, Dead Poets Society.
Dead Poets Society, but he's doing a pretty bad impersonation of it. So he's too full on. Anyway, so the point I'm getting to with all these tangents, because you said, oh, it's such a simple story. And
it
look,
is a simple story, but here's the detail.
There is a difference between story and plot.
Yeah.
She ends this thing by saying, because also Naoki, he's become a shut-in. He won't leave.
Yes.
And we find out later, you know, he's become aggressive in terms of how he cleans everything. He doesn't want anyone
except
to touch
himself.
Except himself. He goes to pot. Yeah. He gets, his nails grow out. Anyway, she asks the question at the end of that section chapter to Miragotchi or Yuko that is this what you expected? What is the actual line is, what do you think of your revenge now?
Yeah.
So essentially saying, look what you've done. This is what you left. These are the destruction you've left in your wake. What do you think of it now?
Yeah.
And at that point, I'm thinking, okay, so this is going to be a story that ultimately looks at the silliness of revenge as undercuts and unlayers the whole concept of revenge and what revenge means.
Yeah.
Except it doesn't. We have that question, and it's a rhetorical question, and it just lingers there for the whole rest of the book and never gets picked
up.
And
certainly I think by the end of the book you go, you could be pretty happy with that, actually.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. If she'd been there to answer that question, she'd gone, bonza.
Good, excellent.
Yeah, great. Move right along.
Possibly hasn't gone as far as I'd like, but okay, it's a start.
But no, what I'm going to do is dismantle a bomb, put it somewhere else, and kill lots more people. That's how into revenge I am.
Yeah. It does escalate, and
and it's a shame because I
did not love this book by the end. I was really, really, I think the similar to you, I was really interested after the first, certainly the first confession and then the second, and I expected it to delve deeper into the psychology and the social aspects that it was talking about and all of this and it, instead everything kind of escalated up. So Naoki, who as I said, we find out he actually had more of a role and a more evil role to play in the daughter's death.
And that's the part of the problem. A lot of these revelations don't really make sense.
No, well,
So think about it.
Yeah.
Think about it here. The girl's been electrocuted.
Yeah.
But he's not dead.
Yeah.
He doesn't know that at that point. He's lifted her up.
Yeah.
About to throw her into the pool. She starts twitching, wakes up, opens her eyes. But because Shuyu had been a real bastard and said basically, fuck you.
I
don't care. I didn't need you in the first place. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
He thinks to himself, ha, you smart guy. You didn't even kill her. Well, I'm going to do it. I'm going to kill her.
Yeah.
And throws her in the pool. And yet, that's not his character up to that point.
It's his character, and it also, he's not his character as it's kind of presented through other people, to be fair. If you read his, before you get to that bit in his own confession, he is not a nice person. And he is very... He's very insecure about the fact that he's not good at stuff.
Yeah, he's an insecure teenager. We should point out that the whole reason a lot of this happened.
Yeah. And they're 13. They're young kids,
they're 13,
they're not like 16, 17, 18-year-olds.
He got bullied at one point.
Yeah.
And he...
And he has no friends. Genuinely thinks Shuyu is his friend.
But before that, he gets bullied and he wanted help from his homeroom teacher, Yuko. So he rings for her, but she doesn't come. The sports teacher comes. And this is the whole thing about how if a boy rings for a female homeroom teacher, they send a male homeroom teacher so that there isn't any sort of entrapment. But he doesn't understand that. He thinks he's being that she is rejecting him, Yuko that is, which is why he is the one who chooses that it should be Manami, her daughter, that Shuya tries to kill with his... Except as we find out, he doesn't know that
He doesn't think at the time. He thinks it's just going to be a prank and she's going to get a shock and cry and get upset and which is weird when you think, because wouldn't she go tell her mother and like he doesn't seem to, which I get, because sometimes kids don't think forward. He isn't thinking forward to the fact that, well, if she's just going to get a shock and get upset and frightened and cry, of course she's going to tell her mother and who did it, and they will get in trouble. But he doesn't think ahead to that, which I think it's not a criticism of the book, because I think that's really that's often how young children and sort of proto teenagers are. You know, they don't think ahead to consequences and what might actually happen 3 or 4 steps down the line. So I think that quite builds into his character of not being able to think ahead so much, not being able to strategize the way she does.
Except for when he drops her in the pool, that's a deliberate cold act that he
does. It is, but again, it's not like it's a spur of the moment thing. It's a, well, I'll show Shuyu, I'm the one who's going to kill her. You know what I mean?
It just didn't sit with me. That's it.
It was, it did seem out of the blue because surely a better revenge would have been to walk out with the child and say, hey, you didn't kill her. Guess what? She's alive. It's like, hey, I'm going to tell everyone now because she's alive. I'm going to tell everyone you tried to kill her. But yeah, but I can kind of.
No, but it's there to up the ante of the plot.
It is. It absolutely is.
And that's where the book starts to lose you because it's not there, I feel, as a natural progression of the character. It's there just to go, oh, my God, he actually... Blah, 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 blah.
No, I get what you mean in that he didn't seem like the type of person who would actually kill someone up until that point.
Yeah, it's quite
a serious step. Like, I bought the whole, I actually liked the idea that he accidentally... Like, he dropped her in the pool. He didn't mean to drop her in the pool. Like, he meant to throw her in the pool, and then at the last minute, she opened her eyes and was like, oh, fuck, she's alive, and he loses her, and then he's too frightened to go in and get her. All of that, that was a really good...
But see, that it all comes back to...
But then that got completely undermined
back to the very simple message here about revenge, because now that we know he really did it...
Yeah, now you go,
well, fuck you. I'm glad you're a sit-in and you've ended up stabbing your mum and all this.
The whole book is about horrible people. Horrible, awful, despicable people who don't care about anybody else and you don't care what happens to them. I mean, that's even the girl, like Mizuki.
Yeah.
She's also a bit of a budding sociopath, I think. Like, there's no one in this book who's.
Well, the fact that her first reaction is, "I'm going to go find the cartons and take them home and test them for."
Oh, look, I think that's fine. That's like, oh, I'll test to see if the teachers, because we should say that Yuko never actually did put AIDS blood in the milk.
She tried to.
Oh no, that's right at the end. That's it. The whole last
20 pages.
Oh, you're right.
Is the most pulpish.
Yes. No, you're right.
Ex post facto rationalization.
So I'd completely like push that out because you're right. So she says, like, throughout the book, she says, "I put AIDS blood in
Yuko says,
milk."
Yep.
Right? Yuko says that. We find out. Actually Mizuki took the milk cart and she tested them. There wasn't blood. Oh, it was all just a ploy. Of course the teacher wouldn't do that, but I mean, telling them that she's done that is cruel enough, and here are the unforeseen consequences, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, as you say, at the very end, we get told that actually she did do it, but I cannot remember his name, but the father of the daughter saw her doing it and went in and swapped out the milk cartons for ones that hadn't been tainted. And it's just like...
The last 20 pages are a convoluted mess.
So she did actually do it.
Let's go through the dot points. I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil this book. Let's go through the dot points. One, I'm going to call him the partner
And also, can we... Because I think this is important because... Right. Can we say also that, if I'm remembering correctly, at no point does Yuko... Is Yuko privileged to the information that, like, before she puts the blood in the milk, that Naoki didn't deliberately throw her daughter into
Correct.
The pool? So she has a boy that she knows, or she thinks set out to kill the girl.
Yes.
Which we find out later he did actually do it.
That was always his plan.
That was his intention. It wasn't just to shock the girl, it was to kill her, right? Because we didn't know that at the beginning. We thought he just meant, whatever. So at no point did Yuko know that Naoki deliberately threw her into the pool after he knew she was still alive.
Correct.
So her revenge on both boys is exactly the same.
So she chooses the same revenge, believing at the time that one did it accidentally.
And believing at the time, like, if that's what you believe, surely you would think that that boy must be already... flagellating himself.
And she says it herself. I can see one of you is sitting there upright, doesn't give a shit. The other one of you is pale and wants to slide under his desk.
In the terms of her not wanting to go through any official channels or have the authorities deal with them, in terms of revenge, surely if that's what she thinks, that this boy accidentally killed a girl that he knew too late was still alive, surely that would actually be revenge enough for that boy.
Yeah, which makes her the most sociopathic of them all.
They're just all horrible, despicable people.
I want to go through this ending.
Yes.
The convolutions.
Yes.
Number one.
Yep.
That the saint, I'm going to call him, the
yes, because that's what she calls him.
He is in a position to see her do what she does and then somehow get into the school and swap the milk for untainted blood. Yes. So there's that.
But not confront her about
it. And not confront her. Not tell her. Yeah, just yeah. Let her keep going. Let it. Yeah, such not, a great not, saint. Not,
hey, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
I know he killed our daughter and we're really upset about it, but you need to step the fuck back, lady.
Yeah, so whatever point she's got, she's just going to continue, you know, regardless of whether there's tainted blood. This stuff, anyway.
And his blood too.
Yeah.
His blood as well. Like, she's implicating him. If anything ever came out, you would be, you know, tested and DNA. And, oh, it's your blood.
But if you know that's going to happen, you say, look, fuck it. Because there's all these aphorisms from him throughout the book of how, you know, revenge is, you know, just.
Yeah. He, in that action, these wise he's words. Then shown up to be a bit of a hypocrite.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Which I don't know, I don't get if that's the point. Because it's so convoluted.
No, I don't think it is.
That's one. Number two, that the homeroom, second homeroom teacher is a disciple of the saint.
Yes.
And although his death, because the saint dies, not the homeroom teacher, the saint dies, Yuko makes sure that the papers know, but they don't advertise it. The details of the funeral is not advertised. This disciple finds out, Tirada, I think his name is, goes to the funeral, and then she manipulates him to become her unwitting spy for that class. Because he doesn't,
and in particular,
she
the
sort
two
of
boys.
Goads him to do things that is only going to make things worse for Naoki and Shuya. But he doesn't know he's doing those things. He thinks he's being Robin Williams. So,
yes.
So there's that. And then finally, well, two things. That Shuya, who thinks he's a genius, would write a blog post detailing his entire plan.
And post it before he does it.
Post it before he does it to give people enough time, in particular.
I've got to say that chapter is, well, not that chapter, because I had assumed in reading that chapter, this was a post that you know, he'd written it and then he time delayed it to.
Yeah,
for God's sake, like, I know it was 2008 the book was written, but it wasn't the Dark Ages. I'm sure he could time set a blog post.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it's cute that they are all blogging, but.
Yeah, so it's like, so he does it, but he puts it there live on his own website, not even just
on
anonymous.
We don't know what the timeline is, whether it was a day before or 2 days before, but there is a period of time, enough time, for our ex homeroom teacher, Yuko. To get under the
school,
take the bomb out.
Yep.
She doesn't just put it in a field somewhere or dismantle it. No, she takes it to a university where Shuya's mother is.
Yeah,
because there's this whole thing about how Shuya has been hoping that his mother would notice
His whole thing is.
Whole abusive mother feedback loop.
Yeah,
She belted the shit out of me, but I still love her. She was. Taken from me because of the abuse she poured on me, but I still want her to be in my life, and I'm trying to get her to notice. But rather than just ring her, which to be fair
or
is mentioned, or email her, or fucking contact her anyway.
I mean, this is the thing, like, and that is hand waved at the end because all the time through this out, Shu's whole thing is like going, dude, send her a fucking email. You know her university.
That's right. You know where
she is. What the fuck are you doing? And that's hand waved. We'll just say that is hand waved at the very end by him saying, well, I guess I knew all along she wouldn't respond. Therefore, I was trying to get her attention in another way. It's like, dude, come on. That was like, that's a bit hand wavy to me.
Yeah. So he's trying to get her attention.
I did not like Shuyu's chapter. It undermined most of the book for me.
Also, and I'll get to that in a second. So to get that final knife twist of revenge, Yuko decides to put the bomb in the university, killing not just this mother, who knows nothing is going on here, but in a bunch of other people as well who are just innocent. So,
and that's in the last chapter. Confession.
What the fuck?
It's like, that's what I mean. Like, everyone, like, any sympathy I had for Yuko, like, even with the blood in the milk, it's like, fuck, that's cold, but I kind of, like, revenge heat, like, not heat of the moment, but still very raw.
No, you've lost a four-year-old child.
There is some sympathy there.
Yeah.
And then you find out she didn't actually put the milk in, and you go, that actually, like, was more sympathy then. It was like, it was just a mind fuck, which is still really cruel and horrible, but they did kill her kid. And at that point, I think very soon after, then you know Naoki also deliberately do it. So your sympathy for Yuko is, I guess, amplified. But then, like, by the end of it, it's like, fuck her. Like, fuck them all.
And then with Shuya's chapter, he also just murders.
Yeah, he's a little sociopath.
Yeah,
he absolutely
there's no
is.
Subtlety, there's no nuance, there's no attempt to do anything more than just turn it. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, he's a complete little sociopath.
And that let me down because the first two sections of the book are so powerful.
Yeah, they really are. And the other thing about this book that, like, every single mother is awful. Like, mothers are awful.
Yes.
They're absolutely awful.
Yes, they are. Yep.
In their role as mothers.
Yes, that's right. And it's interesting.
And whereas all the fathers, like, the best you can say about them is maybe they're a bit neglectful, but just a bit distracted or not paying attention to their kid. Like, you know what I mean? Like, none of the fathers are abusive. None of them are homicidal.
Well, no. The Naoki story sort of begins from the perspective of Naoki's sister.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out. Actually, no, not
Which
Naoki's
was
story.
Weird, wasn't it?
No, because no, it's not Naoki's, Naoki's story. It's the mother's story.
Yeah, but the mother's story is prefaced by the sister going, here's mum's diary. It's like, I don't know why we weren't just given mum's diary.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't know why we had to have this tiny intro bit.
Well,
about.
I know why. Because there's an attempt here to push the plot along. To say that we're not just going back to flashback to Naoki. We're actually saying that, yes, the murders happened and now the sister's involved and she's trying to find out what...
I see what you mean. Like that's right, yes. We get to know at the beginning that the mother's been killed by Naoki. Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, in the mother's section, and I think Naoki's as well, there is this thing about the father who's just never coming home.
He works long hours.
And there's a half attempt in both those sections to put blame on him. Because how did you not know? I mean, there were three people in the house.
Yeah.
How could you not see what was happening to your son? But that doesn't go anywhere.
It doesn't go anywhere.
And at the end of the day, the blame is ultimately laid on the mother.
Like, as I said, the worst you can say about the fathers is maybe they're absent. Like, that's the worst you can say. They're not sadistic like Shuyu's mother. They're not and half of the mother, you know, like Shuyu's mother's also then absent as well.
Yeah.
So she's sadistic and abusive, and then she's absent, and then she rejects her son. Naoki's mother, whose name do we get her name? I can't remember. She may just be Naoki's mother because the diary's like her. She doesn't say her own name. She ends up trying to kill her son.
Yeah.
Because she's so ashamed of who what he's become and. And so on. And of course, Yuku is like, well, look what Yuku does. I mean, they're just awful. Like, it's absolutely awful. I get that that this book is playing against the type of mothers being, you know, loving and nurturing and,
She wrote the book, as it says in the back of the book.
Yeah, as a housewife and mother.
Doing domestic chores. Yeah.
And so, I don't know how much of, like, the way that is framed is quite hypeful. You know, like, it's quite, I think that went into the marketing of the book. Oh, here's this domestic housewife who wrote this terrible book with all this horrible stuff.
Yeah.
So I get that is what the book is doing. The book is undermining this idea of, or perception of motherhood as being, you know, nurturing and loving and perfect. But I kind of think it went a little too far.
Well, look,
like, there could have been a good mother in that book.
We can take it for what it is, which is a pulpish thriller.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I just felt it starts off being so much more than that.
Yeah.
But then
it
just becomes
that pulpish. No, I was very disappointed by the end. And as you say, so many bits which just at the end didn't make a lot of logistical sense. Like, you know, it's like, how did that, why, I don't get why that or how that could have happened. And convolutions that things kind of like run into and so many coincidences, which I guess is a little bit part of this genre. Like, there's a lot of necessary coincidences that happen. So, you know, the boy's mother does end up teaching at the school where the judge for this competition that Shu's device is judged at. And she does end up actually falling in love with that judge, and he does end up seeing a photo on that guy. You know, I mean,
that's the other thing.
All of these coincidences.
Yuko deliberately murders a woman, pregnant woman.
Absolutely. She's pregnant.
Like, knows that.
So she doesn't just kill the mother of the boy to deliberately get back at, because she's read Shu's confession, which is all about how much he loves his horrible mother and wants her to notice him. And he's the only thing she loves. So she says, well, if she's the only thing you love, I'll take her away. But she doesn't even just kill the mother. She kills the mother and her unborn child and however many other dozens of people were in that big building when she blew it up. Like, it's the most, it's the most ridiculous revenge for anyone who is not a sociopath. And then you wonder how much you just question everything you thought you knew about Yuku. Is her entire first chapter confession manipulating the reader as much as it is her class?
Yeah, but I didn't think that in a sort of smart way. I thought this is just.
Yeah, no, I don't think the book is doing that. I think the book is pressing forward with its escalation and so on. But it does. It makes you doubt the narrative you've been told, and as you say, not in a deliberate way.
Well, it makes me wish that the first chapter had just been, the whole thing had just been a novelette and left it at that.
Yeah, yeah. So
anyway,
look, I'm glad I read it. Like it was very interesting the way it was structured and set up, and I really liked looking at the dynamics. Like one of the things it did really well was setting up all of the power dynamics between, you know, the children and their teachers, yeah. And the power dynamics that went both ways, yeah. Like the way that the kids also had control over, yeah, their teachers in some way, and
there's a lot
family.
In the book about there's a lot in the book about respect,
yeah, and like how families are structured and all the I guess the unspoken rules that kind of don't get violated and I wanted more of that, more of that, less over the top fireworks, I guess.
Well, but nonsensical over the top,
yeah,
fireworks.
Yeah. Well, fireworks are nonsense.
And decisions that don't seem to run logically.
No, they don't. Like, as I said, Shou's chapter was.
And why is
Shou
trying to blow himself up?
Because his mother rejected him, right?
But she didn't know. She's not.
No,
doesn't know what the fuck's going on.
She finally got. No, she finally. He finally got. In,
oh, no. No, no. Sorry. No. Yes. Okay.
Right? He finally.
It's an implicit rejection. Yeah. You've gone and met another guy, yeah, and had another child, but. Fuck it, they're divorced, his father and the mother.
Yeah, but he looked at it as in she
sorry,
gave up,
right,
her
he's
career.
He's a sociopath.
Right?
Yeah.
He looked,
yeah,
at it as she gave up her career and abused him because of him,
yeah,
as a child.
It. It's not a pro.
And she,
yeah,
sees her pregnant and about to have another family, and then suddenly it's not, oh, it wasn't about her having a child who happened to be me, it was about me. So, like, I get, he's a sociopath. He's a horrible, horrible, horrible child.
So should we move? Should we move to a second book that is also about a heap of really horrible people?
Horrible people.
We are two
but
books,
but a much more interesting book. Like a much, much, and a book that got more interesting as it went. So yes, we should say the second book. I'll probably announce it properly. It's White Tears by Hari Kunzru, and it was published earlier this year.
Correct.
And not winning of any of the awards you said it would win.
No.
Which is the other reason we're ending the podcast, because your literary credit is
just
fucked.
I get it so fucking wrong. I think it'll, well, I don't know. I'm not going to make any statements you're right. No,
don't.
No.
Keep your sketchy record
you
as intact as it can be.
Did get quite a bit of attention when it came out.
Yeah.
But that was it.
Oh, yeah. As is the case with most books.
And maybe for the book, yep, that was enough to, yep, get the public, you know. To get the sales.
I really liked this book.
I loved this book. I loved this book.
Yeah. It was one of those, I think, increasingly.
Did you read the, can I, okay.
Okay, you, sorry, start, yes.
Did you read the back of the?
No, I bought, okay, it on Kindle. I didn't have a back off.
All right. So, okay. So you read the first 60 pages.
Yeah.
And it reads not like a straight literary novel, but like a really quirky, interesting literary novel.
Yeah, yeah.
And then goes bug fuck. And that's part, and I still have not read the back cover copy. I don't know if what we're about to spoil here is revealed, but part of the joy of reading this was not knowing this was going to become, frankly, a genre novel. That,
yeah, it's a ghost story.
Yeah, it's exactly what
another
it is.
Revenge story, actually.
Yes, it is another revenge
story. Ghostly revenge story.
But there's no indication when you open it that that's what it's going to be.
No, it's a really subtle lead-in, and I think, like, what I've had this conversation, I don't know if I've had it on the podcast, but I've had it with people in the past about some of the limitations of genre. And one of the big limitations, and there's lots of, obviously lots of benefits, yada, 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 but one of the limitations of genre as it's currently, I think, published and marketed is there's not a lot of leeway for authors to have a lead-in to anything. It's like, bang, stuff has to start happening. If it's a genre novel, if it's science fiction, we want the, yeah, science fiction-y thing on the first page. If it's a horror novel, we want the bad thing happening in the first chapter. Like, it's all got to, like, bang, bang, bang. If a novel is not marketed as genre, if it's in the, you know, quote, scare quotes, literary world, they seem to get to do things differently. And I think one of the strengths of this book is that you kind of, your invested in the world and sunk, like, immersed really deeply in the world before the stuff starts happening. So you're kind of alongside the characters as it begins to happen. Whereas instead of, actually, before I go on, we should just give a brief overview of the plot. So, Ian, your turn.
So the plot's quite complicated. So I'd rather read it out from Goodreads, which just so okay. I can actually read what Goodreads have got.
Okay,
because I
sure.
haven't, well, the back cover yep. blurb, because this is the first time I've looked at it. I'm going to skip the from one of the most talented fiction writers.
Sure.
Okay. 220-something New Yorkers. Seth is awkward and shy. Carter is the glamorous heir to one of America's great fortunes. They have one thing in common, an obsession with music. Seth is desperate to reach for the future. Carter is slipping back into the past. When Seth accidentally records an unknown singer in a park, Carter sends it out over the internet, claiming it's a long-lost 1920s blues recording by a musician called Charlie Shaw. When an old collector contacts them to say that their fake record and their fake bluesman are actually real, the two young white men, accompanied by Carter's troubled sister Leonie, spiral down into the heart of the nation's darkness, encountering a suppressed history of greed, envy, revenge, and exploitation. That's a really good blurb, ruined by a top and tail, which says this is a two ambitious young musicians are drawn into the dark underworld of blues record collecting, haunted by ghosts of a repressive past, and then tailed by why tears is a ghost story.
Oh, well, we just said everyone that
a terrifying murder mystery, a timely meditation on race, and I love that it all the forgot. Why the fuck? why say that? That shits me. It does, because that's a lovely little blurb. That blurb sort of, sets it up quite neatly. Why then tell people in the next sentence, oh, by the way, this is a ghost story, just so you know.
I know.
Why?
Well, they're framing the book, I guess. I mean, look, part of
it. But isn't it interesting enough? The mystery of they found this fragment of music.
Well, they didn't find Charlie? A fragment. They recorded, Seth recorded
in a park.
Someone on the street
yes.
at one of those chess games in the park.
Yeah, someone humming the tune.
That's
yep.
right. Well, singing. We get the lyrics, so yep. singing a bit of song, and so it's something he recorded, and that then him and his partner Carter decide to.
Well, they take that recording, they dirty it up.
Yeah, make into something that sounds like a really old 78 sort of recording. And put it out on the internet.
behind all this is Charlie Shaw is a real person.
And Charlie Shaw, that like a name that Carter says he just pulled out of his ass.
Yes.
Ends up being a real person who died before he got to record this song that Seth then recorded. Like, it's this wonderful, beautiful, tangled, it's a really, like, it's a gothic ghost story.
Yes.
It's so amazing.
Where the ghost is manipulating the events from essentially page one.
Pretty much, we just don't know that. We don't pick up on that till about a third of the way through the book. And then it's like, oh, this has just gotten really interesting. that came out wrong. It's a really interesting book from the beginning, but in the sense of suddenly all the pieces beginning to come into focus, that only happens about a third of the way through the book. And then it's like, oh, I see what's happening here.
And
or I think I see what's happening here.
And it's interesting that Kunzru has used the ghost story to tell a story about cultural appropriation and a really powerful story about, a stolen history or...
A stolen history, stolen labour, stolen wealth.
It's... I can't think of anyone who's done this like this.
I've not read a book like this at all. But I mean, like, as we all said, this is one of the
and it's so
really,
angry.
It's so angry. It is so angry.
Because what happens? I mean, because it's not angry to begin with. Seth is.
There are so many barbs all the way through.
True, there are. but
like, for a book written in the first person, there are so many unwitting barbs on
like that thing I just said,
Seth.
Dirty it up, that dirty up the recording, this idea that, it's not genuine and authentic unless it's all scratchy and poppy.
And like the old music that Carter especially is drawn to is all the earliest recordings of music by mostly black musicians and singers, and he thinks they're more authentic than anything white people have done. Like, it's this whole Oh, it just makes your skin crawl.
So it's this idea that white people, so it's called White Tears for a reason, that white people, Carter in particular, are guilty of the past.
Mm.
But their way of dealing with that guilt is to collect this music from black musicians and try to promote it.
You know, I don't think that's it. I don't think they're trying to promote it. I think, and one of the points...
Or restore it, at least. I mean...
Well, keep it. Like, one of the things the book makes they see themselves a point as the curator, over and over and over again is this is not... This is collecting and hoarding behaviour. This is not... we found this music and we're releasing it to the world for the world to enjoy. This is, look at my stuff. Look at what I have found. Look at what I have paid for. Like, there's something more sinister about that. It's not about, like, they're not museum curators who are, you know, finding things and restoring them and releasing them to the general public to enjoy or find out about. They are private collectors who are hoarding things to themselves for their own prestige, their own sense of self-worth, their own sense of pride. That they're the only ones who have this. I mean, it's a really, it's in another sense of the word, it's deeply appropriative, and acquisitional, and it's a continuing process of what has happened for centuries.
Maybe it's false then, but there is this sense, at least with this.
I mean, that's what they think they're doing. They think they're
rescuing things. That's, you know, yeah. They think that.
But for whose benefit?
Yeah,
is the problem, and they are rescuing things, right? They are. They're absolutely, but for whose benefit and for whose financial gain, and who is getting, you know, fairly recompensed for it.
My brain just went blank.
The answer is white people.
it's just that this novel just hit me in the gut so often. And
it doesn't pull any punches, and it shouldn't pull any punches. I mean, like, the back section of it is we're going to spoil this book, but we're not really, because it's a wonderful, wonderful book. And even if you knew all the plot details, like, the reading experience of
the prose is astonishing. It's beautiful.
So the ghost story, the thread of the ghost story is that Charles Shaw, who is the black musician, who has become the ghost who Seth records and who he gradually begins to infiltrate Seth and Carter's world. And we get the sense, I mean, we're told at the end, the ghost of Charles Shaw rides Seth, as in like a voodoo riding. So he possesses Seth's body and makes Seth, in the end, kill Carter's parents and Carter's brother.
Without Seth knowing.
Without Seth being...
fully cognizant, at least to begin
conscious
with.
Conscious of it as it happens.
Yes.
He just uses Seth's body and Seth is somewhere else. And so then in retrospect, you think, well, then he must, like, Seth, being ridden by Charles, must have beat up Carter and put him in the coma as well. And, you know, all these things which happened along the way, Leonie's death, which is the one thing I had a problem with, but we'll get to that. Obviously, it was all Seth.
Yep.
Right? Or was it? Because there are some interesting things. But I don't think it matters. But the reason Charles Shaw is... pinned to Seth is because Seth is convenient. He's a convenient vehicle to use to get to the Wallace family. And the reason why Charles Shaw, the ghost, is linked to the Wallace family is because it was the ancestors of the Wallace family that caused the death of Charles Shaw and prevented him, more importantly, prevented him from getting to a hotel in the 1920s to record this song that might have been, who knows, might have been his ticket to another life. So the motivation for this ghost is to finally get to this hotel and record this song, which he kind of does in a way. And then, of course, to take his revenge on the Wallace clan. And it's that story which unfolds in, I guess, the last quarter of the book in a really dramatic and visceral way. And it's an incredibly clear articulation. Like it's been articulated extremely well in numerous other places, but it's the clearest articulation in the context of a fiction, in the context of a novel that I've read, that draws this straight as an arrow line from the people who owned slaves, who abused the labor of slaves, and then later of free black people by arresting them on spurious grounds and making them work as hard labor for white people. There's a line in there that one of the white chain gang bosses says, I think, I don't know if he says it to one of the black prisoners who he's, or they just overhear him, but he says, you know, it's like, if a Negro dies, I get another Negro. If a mule dies, I got to buy another mule. So this idea that this labor is just endless and free, and this is what empires are built on. This is what the Wallace family's financial empire has been directly built on. This is why Carter has all the benefits he has. This, you know, it's this really articulate rendering of the argument. And it's done superbly. And as you say, it's done with anger and without pulling punches. It's quite an incredible piece of fiction.
So you're talking about Leonie before, and she's a very interesting character.
Yeah.
Because it's not clear whether so class plays a big role in this book as well. It isn't just about cultural appropriation. It's also about the poor versus the rich. And partly that is, you know, the oppressed minorities being poor and...
Yeah.
And you, like you said, having an opportunity to use their talents to get to find wealth or just get out of the life that they're in. But also Seth himself. Seth is not down on his luck, but he's a student, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, well, when he meets Carter, he's a student.
Yeah, and Carter is rich and Carter's happy to pay because he's fascinating what Seth does, because Seth walks around parks recording stuff and, you know, turning it into weird shit and Carter finds that all, you know... So is it Carter or Charlie? I'm getting Carter.
It's Carter. Yeah. Carter is the Trustafarian.
Yeah, Trustafarian, that's right. And Carter, you know, and Carter gets all fascinated in that. But Carter's sister, Leonie, is beautiful and gorgeous.
An artist and a socialite.
That's the only sort of dull note in the whole thing, that she is, that in Seth's eyes, she is this glory to be to God.
Look, I can...
she's amped up to a level which makes what happens to her all the more upsetting and
it's
bit
what
annoying.
Happens to her, because it is a first person narrative from Seth, this entire book. All of like his idea of who Leonie is, I can filter that through Seth and bring with that the whole Madonna whore thing that, you know, he obviously has in his head, because the way he speaks about other women is not flattering. All of that I can deal with. But when the facts of the book become something out of a 1990s, 80s, 70s, 2000s horror movie, whereas, you know, the girl has sex, bang, she's brutally murdered, that struck a really dull note, because that's no longer Seth's perception. And she's not murdered in the book because she has sex with Seth. She's murdered because she's part of the Wallace family, and this is Charles Shaw working his way through the family. But the fact that it happens that way in the book, when there was no real reason for Seth and Leonie, like, she didn't even really like him.
She treats him like a pet.
Yeah, it's a really weird scene, even where they do have sex. So I'm half wondering if that even happened because of the way it's treated in the book. But it's certainly presented as something.
She's devastated because before that, her brother has just shit panned out of him. He's in a coma.
Yeah,
coma.
He's pretty much.
And that's what brings them together. I mean, she knows Seth before that, but Seth is really a pet to her.
Yeah, he's got a crush on her, and that's about.
And she knows that.
Yeah.
But now that her brother has just been hurt, and she knows that it's got something to do with this whole
collection. They're on a road trip to go and find this recording that Seth has been trying to track down, allegedly of Charles Shaw. And she gets he may or may not go away one morning from their motel, and while he is or is not away, she gets brutally, savagely murdered. And it's just like if they hadn't had the sex, it would just be one of those things. I think it's the fact that, as I said, it just follows this really old, really faded, really worn horror trope of, oh, when the girl has sex, then that's when she dies. And I don't, there's not any suggestion of self-awareness about that in the book when that happens. It's just a, oh, poor Seth.
It's more than that.
He's getting framed for the death of
It's more than that. Seth gets to, aspirationally, that's what Seth wants. He wants to shag Leonie. He gets to do that.
Yeah, that's what I meant. And then she... And then she gets taken away from him.
So I suppose, I hate the term, but it's, I suppose it's a fridging of some sort because it's...
It is because the whole thing is to... that whole thing then kicks off the Seth's... From Seth's point of view, the way his memories begin to cross over and bleed through with Charles Shaw and what has happened to Charles Shaw in the past, Seth experiences. And that it's a, like it's a really good section of the book. I just wish... Not that Leonie hadn't been killed, I'm fine with that. I just wish there hadn't been the sex beforehand because it was right beforehand, right? And then the next morning, bang. So it's just it just felt tacky and it was unnecessary. It could have just continued to be this really, really well-wrought relationship actually with this sister who we don't get to know that well, who is kind of trying to find out what's happening to her brother and the young man who has this crush on her that's unrequited. And that could have been the relationship. And it was really well done.
Well, she's a product of a dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
Where money has not necessarily created a good life for her brother. Yes, you're
going
to...
Oh, no, keep going, yeah.
You know, I'm just saying, she's...
poor rich people.
Well...
No, seriously, right? Rich people.
But that's part of the joke of the book. We're not meant to feel sympathy for her in that sense.
Yeah.
But just the fact that, you know, she's that they are a dysfunctional family.
And as are most families.
Yeah, true. Say. No, but yeah, look, poor rich people. The book is called White Tears, so...
No, like from the start, you know, what you're getting into. It's like... And it's funny because as I read the book, when there was that scene where they had sex, or maybe didn't, but probably did, it's like I had this double reaction. Part was like, oh, God, I wish this hadn't happened. It was a really interesting relationship. It's like, oh, I hope she doesn't die in the next chapter.
and then
she did. It's like, oh, dude. It's like, Kunzru, did you have to do that? It's just so, it's so passe, I guess. So for me, that was the one off-key note in the book, which was a shame because everything else was sort of pitch perfect. It was fantastic.
So is, from a larger, a broader perspective, is the thing here, systemic racism is really the fault of rich people because they're the ones who get punished in this book. Seth is just a vehicle. It could have been anyone.
Seth is a vehicle.
But
let's face it, Seth is punished too.
Yeah, but
he's not getting out of because he goes into a hotel, like his body goes into a hotel, slaughters the rest of the Wallace people, comes out, is arrested. There's a lovely line that says how he's, you know, guns pointed at him, he's on the ground, he gets helped up and escorted the police car, and if he was black, he'd probably be dead because they would have just shot him. Like the book just... It doesn't hold back anywhere. It's just constantly pointing out things. And so he's going to spend the rest of his life either in jail or in some kind of an institution. So it's not like he's getting off scot-free either.
No, but I mean...
And in fact, it's not fair. Like, all of this happened before I was even born. How is any of this my fault? And like that's kind of the line throughout the whole book. But there's a difference between... something being your fault and you benefiting from something. And that's the key difference. And I think in a lot of the conversations around inequity and inequality and appropriation and all those conversations, I think a lot of people, and let's face it, a lot of privileged people, immediately get defensive and immediately read that as they're being told that it's their personal individual fault. That stuff happened in the past before they were even born. And stuff which is your fault is stuff that you do in your lifetime. And that's where your blame sits and that's what you carry. So you personally, as a individual, do not carry blame for things that happened in the past. But you may benefit from that. And your refusal to acknowledge the benefits you have and... to attempt to dismantle or share those benefits, or at least to support people who are trying to do that, that is where Blaine can attract to you. Seth doesn't get it. None of them get it.
He never acknowledges it.
No, none of them. It's all just, oh, it wasn't my fault. It happened before I was born.
That's
it's
right.
And it's not about saying that the past is your fault. It's about saying the present is your fault. What happens in the present, what you do and don't do in the present is where blame can attract. And where responsibility lies. I mean, what has the Wallace family been doing except, you know, like nothing, you know? It's like where...
Well, they've built an empire on the bones of black people.
Absolutely. And they've profited from,
and yes,
from Seth, abuse correct. And labour. And the other thing the book does, this book draws an absolute line from slavery and slavery of people who were brought from Africa all the way through to current incarcerality rates, which are overwhelming. Like in terms of percentage of the population, the number of people in American prisons who are black, and in Australia too, I'll say too, the carcerality rates of Indigenous Australians, I don't have the figures on me, but they're much, much higher than the proportion in the general population. And the same is true in America for people of colour. And if you're imprisoned in America, you know, you work for like pennies, if anything. Your labour is getting outsourced these days to private companies who, I mean, it's an entire, oh, it makes me so angry because this is again, private enterprise and trusts and corporations, the vast majority of which are run by rich white people who are again benefiting from the exploitation of poor black people and other poor people as well. It's not like there's only black people in prison, but it's an overwhelming statistic in terms of the ratio of the
And when you say it like that, it makes this book sound like an earnest, dull, on-the-nose plod.
It's not on-the-nose. It's just, as you say, very, very angry. It's not hiding any of this stuff. It's like, this is how it is. And I read a review, I forget where, but I just skimmed over it last night, that was talking about how that's controversial. Like, talking about carcerality as an extension of exploitation of people of colour in America.
Really?
And I know, I was like, is that controversial? I didn't realise. Apparently it is controversial.
Because, see, it's funny. For some people, this would be a provocative book. It would just be too much. There'd be too much, and they would see it as they would actually come on the side of Seth at the end and say, it's not fair. Seth doesn't deserve to go through this. He doesn't deserve to be the vehicle of this ghost and cause the thing and you know, be involved in.
And you know what? Maybe that isn't fair. So fucking what? Seriously, so fucking what?
That's what Kunzer is saying. Right?
Because what? Because what is the rallying cry of fucking right-wing racists everywhere? Get over it. Stuff isn't fair. Pull up your bootstraps.
Your
snowflakes. Get over it. It's stuff just isn't fair. Live with it. Well, you know what? Maybe what happened to Seth isn't fucking fair. So what? Stuff happens that isn't fair. I mean, what's not fair is an ongoing systemic exploitation and abuse and theft from various people in a society by a very small amount of people who benefit at the top. That's what's not fair. And talking about, you know, individual cases, I mean, are important for individuals, obviously, but they're not about dismantling systems. I mean, and this book is drawing very clear lines between history and the present and saying it's not over. None of this is over.
I know, and this is why I love this book
this
so much, because it merges together the two things that people have tried to split apart and have angry debates about, which is identity and identity politics and class politics.
Yeah.
And I think it merges them together.
There's a massive overlap.
Of course, well, of course there is. And Seth is very much that example of labour being abused by a black man, a ghost, but not just Charlie, it by the situation he's in, by the fact that he's willing to or unwilling to put his to be in Carter's life and get involved in that life. He is
because let's face it, Seth.
Seth still has more choices than Charlie ever had in a chain gang in the 1920s.
Here's the thing, Seth. Okay, he keeps saying, you know, I'm not one of these rich people. I don't know what my family did in the past. Blah blah. You know what? Seth is benefiting directly from being Carter's friend. Seth is managing to live a life that he wouldn't be able to live if he wasn't Carter's friend. You know, he's getting, like, until it all collapses and then he realises exactly what's been taken away from him. And like, oh, it's not fair that it's been taken away. Was it fair that you got it all for free, Seth? You know, like he doesn't complain that, oh, he's been treated with immense privilege benefit because of Carter. Like, he doesn't complain about how unfair that is.
And he gets it's all, only unfair he gets all
when
stroppy.
It gets taken away.
He gets all stroppy when Carter doesn't pay him attention and disappears Seth, for days on end.
Seth is a ridiculous person. Like, like, I don't, like, not a ridiculous character. He's exquisitely drawn, but he's a ridiculous person. Like, it's this idea that if I get all this stuff, somehow that's fair and just and that's what I deserve. As soon as it's taken away, this stuff that I didn't earn, that I didn't work for, that I didn't...
Correct.
Somehow
that's
unfair.
He's one of those guys...
It's like, oh, fuck
He's one of those
Seth.
Guys... Exactly. He's one
I
of those guys
he's called
who,
Seth.
Why?
I hate that name
I'll do
so
it. He's one of those guys as
Sorry,
well who's
Seth's
all about the art. Who's all about the art. Because this is all this stuff
about
recording in the park.
The art.
And, you know, it's all being indie and all about the art.
This idea
but
that
doesn't consider that there's a world outside that art and that his art itself, and I don't want to use the word, I'm not going to say problematic, but his art itself has antecedents that he's not willing to acknowledge.
That's it.
Or deal with.
That's it. For Seth and Carter, they get to say, this is just music. This is just music that we happen to like. And they can say that. And they are able to divorce history from the music. They're able to forget about the context in which the music was recorded in terms of the lives of the people who recorded it and what they had to do. And
Seth
this is something that
Seth
gets told. Like, he experiences it viscerally at the end of the book. And at the end of the book, he's still saying it's not fair. It's like, fuck you, Seth.
Seth is punished.
I love that this Seth character is never redeemed.
Seth
I love
is punished
that.
For recording this music, for not acknowledging what it really is in terms of its history and from where it comes from, and for dirtying it up and for sending it out into the world and blah blah blah, and thinking that, oh, isn't that cool what I just did? And just seeing it as a commodity, and isn't it cool?
Yeah, but also I think you're right in that, like, I mean, he's punished, you know, quote unquote, by what happens to him at the end of the book, I guess. But I think you're right in that you said he's not punished in the sense of a direct thing. He's collateral damage.
He is collateral damage, but he doesn't question. He only really starts to question, and even that it's minimal when his mate gets the crap pounded out of him and Leonie. Yeah. In fact, Leonie's the trigger to a lot of this.
No, he's a really passive character. He just goes along and does what... And this is the thing. He's passive. He just goes along. He does what he
and
wants
we all
to
are.
Do.
That's the tragedy.
Yeah. Like, that's the thing. He does what he wants to do. He doesn't think about anything else. And it's just... This is Seth. And as you say, this is most of us. You know, it's... But I just don't... Like, as I said, I really love that at the end of the book, there isn't some... And that would be on the nose. If Seth at the end of the book had some revelation about, oh my God, everything was really horrible and I have... No, he's still just like, oh, it's not fair. Like, he is... It's a perfect ending. It's such a good ending. Like, he has the cognizance to note that when he's arrested, if he was a black man, he would probably have been shot instead of, you know, very carefully contained and arrested and escorted into a police car for killing these rich white people. So he's able to note things, but he's not really...
He doesn't internalize it.
He's not with it. He's not on the program. He's still about how everything is unfair. And
anyway.
Yeah, it's like, but it... And then in terms of all of that aside, like, the language of this book is wonderful. The whole first-person narrative and how Kunzru manages to, as we said, really gradually weave in the non-realist element. So you don't kind of question them at first.
You do,
like,
yeah, it is, yeah.
Like, when they make the guy on the street who Seth records, who we later realise is the ghost of Charles Shaw.
Yeah.
Just a guy on the street. Like, there's a weird thing. Like, there seems to be time lost, but that might be Seth vaguing out or something. Like, it's just a weird thing, and Seth glosses over it because Seth glosses over everything. That's his core character function, is to gloss over shit that's unpleasant or doesn't make sense. And then when they record the song and put it on the internet, and Carter makes up the name, and then they get an email from someone who goes, oh, I know Charles Shaw. And it's like, oh, it's like, well, how can you? We made up the name. Like, what a weird... Like, everything is... All these things happen. And on a second reading, I think those things would stand out a lot more and you'd be able to follow the thread of the ghost story from the start. But as you're reading it, you're so immersed in the position of Seth that you gloss them aside as well as the reader. It's like, oh, that's an odd thing. Okay. And you keep reading.
It's why it's such a beautifully structured book. It really is such a smart piece of writing.
It really is.
And I have nothing more to say about it, but I just want more people to read it. It's one of those books I've noticed that hasn't really gotten it did get good critical attention when came out, but yes, I'm going to say it. I want to see it on awards ballots next year.
I would love to see this book on the Shirley Jackson ballot. Because it is like this wonderful, exquisite, beautifully crafted piece of 21st century Gothic fiction. And it's just so wonderfully done. It belongs on the Shirley Jackson
That has
ballot.
Something to say, very clearly.
Absolutely. It has a lot of things to say. I think it's exquisite. So I am, if that's the case, I am quite sad that more people haven't read it. But I'm sure it's sold a lot of copies.
I hope it has.
Oh, how many people have read it on Goodreads? Oh. That's our litmus test, isn't it? Well, how many people have read it on Goodreads?
Okay, to be fair, it's had nearly 1,900 ratings and 393 reviews. So it's not...
Yeah, but that's not huge for Goodreads, so...
Well, it's not bad. Yeah.
Like, how much has Confessions got?
Nearly 5,000. It has been out through a couple of years longer.
Yeah, that's true.
Look, just go out and read this book.
Yeah, it's really, really good and superbly written and it's... Like, it just holds the line. It kind of never steps back. It never pulls a punch.
Not a single punch.
You know, it's a really, really good book. And it's a creepy book. Like, yes. once that ghost story part of it really gets going, mostly because for a great part of that, the reader doesn't quite know what's happening either. Like, as much as Seth doesn't know what's really happening.
Well, I kept saying, is this a ghost story?
I know. It's like, is it a ghost story or is this flash? Like, what? Like, so you're just as muddled and confused in a good way as Seth is.
You're
like,
going, wait, this is a ghost story.
Like, the author does this amazing job of situating the reader right alongside Seth. You are so intimately connected to that point of view. It's such a good book.
When I realised, it just blew me away. I realised, wait, I've been reading a ghost story all this time and didn't know it. That's just something I've not experienced
before. I know, because I went into it, because you told me it's like a horror-ish novel. But I mean, horror doesn't even need to have any supernatural
in it. No, it could have been a serial killer novel.
Yeah, it's like, oh, because it's going to be some collector who's going to come out and name a collector. You know, like, so I had no idea what the horror element was. So the book is so superb. But as I said, now that you know, listeners, if you haven't already read it, I don't think it will spoil the book. In fact, like, you'll get to have that experience of being able to pick it, like pick the little clues as they come through.
Exactly.
So I will read it again in a couple of years.
Well, I won't unless I'm doing a podcast on it, like Confessions.
No, because I want to, because I'm really interested to see how this stuff gets drip fed through the book.
Okay.
Well,
should we wrap up?
We should wrap up.
So what is our final podcast going to be?
Final podcast. Oh, that sounds sad. So it's a bit odd. We're going to do two debut novels by the same author.
But how can they be a debut novel if it's by the same author?
It's a really odd occurrence. And I will say I haven't actually read either of them. I hope I like them because I do know this author. So it'll be awkward.
This whole thing is fraught.
It'll be awkward if I don't like them. Anyway, so there's a novel called How to Be by Bren McDibble. And that is a, what our American friend would call a middle grade novel. Or maybe slightly less than. But anyway, so it's a young person's novel. And the
younger than us.
Much younger than us. But we're going to read it anyway. And the second one is called Dark Places by her pseudonym, Callie Black. So they're both debut in the sense they're both the first novels by those names. But it's an interesting story that I will relate next episode about how that came about anyway.
So is that a young adult, the second one?
The second one is a young adult.
It's firmly a young adult.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is actually the reason why it's under the name Callie Black and not Bren McDibble. But as I said, we will talk about a bit more about that next month. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm kind of looking forward to it being her last episode, but I'm also a bit sad.
Well, we'll talk about that. We will talk about that too.
Yes.
It might be a long episode, but we'll...
It might be a little longer than normal, yeah. But yeah. I promise it won't be so long that I have to break it into two, because that would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
Though, if you made it so long that I had to break it into three, that would take us up to 70.
Why not make it so long that we could splice it out for the next 12 months?
Bring a sleeping bag.
Yeah.
We'll have a sleepover.
We'll do 20 hours shit, and we'll just go... Part 18 of that time okay. that Kirsten and Ian ended their podcast.
One of them's dead now. We've still got recordings.
Which one?
You'll have to find out.
That's so morbid.
Please send feedback by commenting at the website, which is writeandcritic.podbean.com. Send an email to writeandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us at Writer and Critic on Twitter, and we'll keep our Twitter account and everything going. What we won't keep going is our Patreon page, because I think once we're pretty much finished, that's a bit null and void.
Yes.
So I'm not going to ask you to sponsor us on Patreon, and if you already do, it is completely up to you whether you stay on board for the next episode or not, but after the next episode, I will be... closing the Patreon account with many, many, many thanks.
Many thanks.
And part of the funds that are left over will go towards keeping our podcast live and stored and archived where it currently lives for at least 2 or 3 years.
Yes. And so we'll it's reset. Yes. So the money isn't just going to go straight to me.
It is not going to go to Ian.
I just wanted people to know that.
Okay. Thank you all for listening. And we will see you next month for the last month.
Wicked Wings.
Bye.
Bye.
Is that going to make a sound?
Oh, shut up. Just start. No, it's not. It's gone silent. It's the
Is
whole...
Is it going to do the vibrate?
No, I don't have vibrate on. I don't like vibrate. So no, it won't. All right? And I'll look up. Put it like that.
That'll make a sound.
No, it will not make
it just
a sound.
It just did.
You
just thumped it.
Because of that.
Yeah, stop it.
What? Please, God, start.
I'm so glad we're finishing.